Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. How can we make sense of the staggering history of loss? Loss of reason, loss of life, loss of hope for the future, represented by World War I. In 2014, University of Washington professor Robin McCabe launched a three-part series of concerts with accompanying lectures to explore that question through music. The theme, inspired by the centenary of the start of World War I, was Music from the War to End All Wars. Speakers Forum aired part one, featuring a talk by UW Dean Robert Stacey this past January. Part two of the series presents a talk by UW professor Ronald Moore, Music in the Silentness of Duty, Peace Where the Shell Storms Sprouted Red. Professor Moore teaches in the Department of Philosophy at UW and is a former director of the UW Center for the Humanities. You may also recognize him as the person who, in his role as university marshal, carried the mace at UW commencements and convocations for 19 years. Moore calls himself someone who is fond of beauty and goodness. That notion becomes highly evident in this talk. In the concert portion, UW School of Music students, led by McCabe, performed works by Bartok, Prokofiev, and Ravel. Professor McCabe says of the series, "World War I was to be, it was hoped, the war to end all wars. The irony of this innocent resolution is not lost on us today. And if the past can inform the present and even enlighten the potentials of our future, then I think this concert series has an important and enduring impact on our student performers, our faculty speakers, and our audiences." We think you'll agree. The University of Washington presented this talk and concert at the Breishman Auditorium on Sunday, March 8, 2014. Many thanks to Mr. Gary Louie for this recording.
Welcome to our second of our three concerts involving the anniversary of World War I. We had severe competition today with the weather, so I'm doubly grateful for those of you who've let music and art win over nature. I don't think you'll regret it. It's been my pleasure to call Ron Moore a friend and colleague for a number of years now, and I was so delighted when he accepted our invitation to speak today. A beautiful mind, a polymath, tremendous insights about music and art and painting. We've had many wonderful conversations over the years. But the thought I leave you with is something that I've always been impressed with him. He has an immense delectation for life itself. He savors the world around him, and every moment for him is special, and he radiates something special because of this. When I talk to Ron about J.S. Bach, I want to go home and play some Bach myself. And when I talk to him about Chopin and Delacroix, I want to look at pictures. And when he tells me about a crazy Italian painter who paints the fruit pieces on people's heads, I have to go and learn about Archimboldo. So this is the kind of wonderful scholar and humanist we have today. He will speak with passion and compassion, and I think leave you with some wonderful insights which will set up the music in a wonderful way. Please help me welcome Ron Moore.
On December 7th, the first presentation of this series, Dean Robert Stacey gave us a rich and powerful sense of the confluence of factors that led up to the First World War and showed us how the arts comprehended the changes that were afoot. Tonight, I want to take you into the trenches, into the high hopes and agonizing realities of the bloodiest confrontation that mankind had ever engaged in, pointing out some ways in which the arts helped us see and understand what took place. On Sunday, October 25th, 1914, Michel Corday, a 45-year-old civil servant in the French Ministry of Commerce and Post, wrote this in his diary. "Every thought and event caused by the outbreak of war struck against the conviction that was in my heart. The concept of progress, of movement toward ever greater happiness, It meant that my faith simply crumbled. The outbreak of war marked my awakening from a dream I had nourished ever since I had started thinking. Corday's dream was a dream shared by most Europeans of the day, and what a dream it had been. It seemed that civilization was on an inexorable upward course. The evidence of progress was everywhere. The burgeoning of industry and concomitantly of wealth, luxury, technology, and the arts, the advances of science, the spread of literacy and education. The noble dream from which Corday awoke was the gospel of meliorism, the view promoted by scholars, clerics, and the popular press that the advance of science, technology, and artistic genius was conquering the darkness day by day and leading mankind toward a world of greater health, plenitude, beauty, and commonweal. You get a sense of the spirit of the day in listening to Ralph Vaughan Williams' lovely romance for orchestra, The Lark Ascending, begun in 1914. It's based on George Meredith's poem of the same name, in which the title bird is portrayed as carrying us all upward in his gyre. For singing till his heaven fills, 'tis love of earth that he instills, and every winging up and up, our valley is his golden cup, and he the wine which overflows to lift us with him as he goes. Then, in a moment, the crazy, unthinkable moment of Archduke Ferdinand's assassination, Europe was shaken awake, and the noble dream was done. But what, staggering forward from their slumbers, did these people see? We have become so used to war, so numbed by the casualty counts, so familiar with the images of broken bodies and pockmarked buildings, that we can easily forget the innocent vision of those first days of 1914. They were days of stability, permanence, and boundless optimism. All right, they thought. There's been a broken riser on the grand upward staircase, but we'll fix it quickly and move on. If we have to go to war, we will. But really not much of an undertaking. Some marches, cannonades, trumpets, drums, perhaps bagpipes. It'll be over quickly, and we can dust off our tunics and get back to the business of peace and progress. And why wouldn't they think that? There hadn't been a serious war in Europe since 1871. The young couldn't imagine, let alone remember, the actuality of combat. Newly recruited infantrymen swelled with patriotic pride and enthusiasm. They saw the enemy as something like the team on the other side of the field. Their officers were comfortable in their medley of nationalistic zeal and sportive intuitions. They loved the fancy dress uniforms, the glitter, and the gamesmanship. Sir John French, who led the British at the Western Front, was confident of success, he said, because his best officers were countrymen of position and influence, accustomed to hunting, polo, and field sports. The profoundly naive notion that this war was to be won in the way that an athletic match was to be won persisted well into the ensuing campaigns. British army units began to initiate their attacks on German lines by kicking a soccer ball or rugby football in the enemy's direction. This remarkable practice continued up to the disastrous Battle of the Somme, in which one company commander handed four soccer balls to his four platoons and offered a prize to the platoon that first kicked its ball up to the German line, a mile and a quarter away. Heady nationalistic pride was the order of the day on all sides. As a German troop train pulled away from the station in August of 1914, 12-year-old schoolgirl Elfriede Kuhr recorded in her diary that the cheering rose into a roar. The soldiers' faces crowded in the open spaces. Flowers flew in the air, and the voices from the train rang out, "Until we meet again, we'll be home with you soon. Don't be afraid. We'll soon be home." 600 miles to the east. A 39-year-old Maurice Ravel wrote to his brother that he was working furiously on his piano trio so as to finish it before enlisting. "Vive la France," he wrote, "but above all, down with Germany and Austria. And with all my heart, long live the Internationale and peace. That's why I'm signing up." His aspirations were soon to be dashed when he was rejected by the service as underweight. "Oh my God," he agonized, "when I think that my physical condition will prevent me from experiencing the splendid moments of this holy war and taking part in the most grandiose, the noblest action which has ever been seen in the history of humanity, even including the French Revolution." In the end, he did take part, caring for wounded personnel in a military hospital and then driving a lorry for the 13th Artillery Regiment. And 200 miles to the north, in the heart of London, Rupert Brooke talked himself into enlisting when he set aside his resentment at the prospect of arduous training and, as he put it, vaguely imagined a series of heroic feats, vast enterprise, and the applause of crowds. He joined the Navy. Later in 1914, he wrote a set of 5 sonnets that made him one of the most celebrated of war poets. In the first, called Peace, he admonishes shirkers and extols the war's energizing virtue. It has, he says, caught our youth and wakened us from sleeping with hand made sure, clear eye, and sharpened power to turn as swimmers into cleanness leaping, glad from a world grown cold and weary. Again the athletic trope, again the welcoming, thrilling plunge. In the 5th and most familiar sonnet, Brooke lauds both country and calling. "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped and made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her waves to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by sons of home." Everywhere one looked, at the outset of the Great War, Europe was suffused with a sense of grand prospect, of patriotic mission, and of glory. In every crowd and on every corner, one could feel the popular exhilaration at prospects of a grand adventure. It was not long, however, before Brooke's simile of swimmers leaping into a clean, clear pond would be exposed as a grotesque mockery of the reality of war. The shocking truth of 1915 was that the battlefield in Europe was a blasted, cratered, dismal hell, not at all like a playing field or swimming hole. In it, the operations of combat were agonizing, bloody, crude blows and counterblows with no vestige of the elegance and finesse of familiar British field games. By then, the main lines of combat were carved into muddy, stinking, bloody trenches stretching 400 miles from the North Sea to southern France, zigging and zagging to prevent clear shooting lanes if they were overrun. The total length of British trenches alone exceeded 6,000 miles. Over months and months, the lines moved a few yards, or at great cost, as much as a few miles. But the wide-awake world of war was preponderantly one of agonizing stasis, never-ending hazard, and misery. Edward Blunden, the British poet, described his first exposure to a front-line trench after arriving in Flanders in this way. "At some points in the trench, bones pierced through and skulls appeared like mushrooms. And there was a pit, the result of much sandbag filling. Among its broken spades and empty tins, I found a pair of boots. still containing someone's feet. When from time to time the order came to go over the top, to race toward the enemy and win his trenches, the carnage was as horrible as it was predictable. No matter where the lines, the no man's land between them was a shell-pocked, corpse-littered shooting range, crisscrossed with razor-sharp barbed wire and cleared by cannon and rifle fire of all vegetation and shelter. Still the orders came to charge and charge and again to charge. The attackers marched forward in broad daylight in orderly rows because their officers insisted on it, thinking that it was the only way that proper discipline could be maintained. Ideas such as misdirection, foray raids, and commando tactics were thought to be unsporting. The defenders' machine guns swept the rows, and column upon column fell until the bodies were piled 3 and 4 deep. And then there was the gas. Beginning in April of 1915 at Ypres, the German forces unleashed cannonades of poison chlorine and phosgene gas, propelling a greenish-yellow mist across the entire battlefield. The affected combatants fell, choking, gagging, and convulsing. The historian Trevor Wilson observed, "For all of recorded history, soldiers had believed that victory went to the manly, the fearless, and the daring. Now, with deadly gas brought to you not by the hand of an enemy you could see and slay, but by the very wind, all bravery seemed useless." What was real was so horrible that it seemed impossible that it be real. It was a time of cataclysmic disillusionment. Dumbfounded, Sir Horatio Herbert Kitchener wired a famously brief summary observation to his foreign secretary. "This is not war. It isn't war." But of course it was. What it wasn't was anything that thinkers and planners of the day could have imagined war becoming. The greatest casualty of the Great War was, ironically, the idea of what war amounted to, what could be expected when nations went to war. War was supposed to be a series of nicely managed clashes on brightly lit battlefields with neatly arrayed combatants, at the end of which perhaps both sides would retire for tea or beer. This war had become a deep, dark, terrifying pit into which everyone peered with agonizing ignorance. It was a great turning point in history, one of the greatest. The incomprehensibility and dread that overwhelmed the thinking of the day ushered in a spirit of modernity that endures into our own time, a spirit in which hope and aspiration are tempered with a nagging sense of absurdity and an acceptance of the unreliability of received wisdom. What on earth can we expect, we think, if this can happen? Many of us recall the uncertainty that gripped this region when Mount St. Helens began to erupt. Not only what will happen as that ash cloud spreads, but will it ever stop? Is this the beginning of unending ruination? We worried about the mountain, but we worried more about the indecipherable future. In the 21st century, we've become accustomed to war and the routine reporting of war casualties. When the PBS NewsHour honored the dead of our Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns by showing their photographs in silence, my wife and I would always stop what we were doing and attend to those young faces, feeling some small measure of the grief others felt so much more intensely. One night, to our horror, one of those faces was that of Will Stacy, the son of the previous lecturer in this series. Even that somber catalog, however, cannot begin to capture the sense of the tragic loss in World War I, a loss compounded by the sheer volume of casualties. There could be no individualized silent gestures for daily deaths in the hundreds or the thousands. On July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme, launched by those four soccer balls, 20,000 British soldiers were killed and 40,000 more wounded in one day. And for many days afterward, the dying wounded cried out in no man's land. It's hard for us now to fathom the catastrophic conditions in which the Great War was fought. Weapons were comparatively primitive, but perhaps deadlier than their modern counterparts due to the lack of medical means to prevent wounds from turning fatal. Disease was rampant in the trenches. Shelter was inadequate. Equipment wasn't designed to withstand the torrents of rain and snow, let alone shell fragments and razor wire. Thousands of soldiers died of pneumonia or froze to death without taking a single enemy bullet. Perhaps the most horrific battle of all took place in July of 1917 at Passchendaele in Belgium. The British forces had softened up the enemy by firing 4 million artillery rounds over a 10-day period. As soon as they were done, torrential rains, the heaviest rains in 30 years, began, and the shell-pocked battlefield was turned into a quagmire the consistency of porridge. John Mortimer Wheeler was there at Passchendaele, later a renowned archaeologist. He reported in his diary, "I cannot attempt to describe the conditions under which we're fighting. Anything I could write about them would seem an exaggeration, but would in reality be miles from the truth. The mud is not so much mud as a fathomless, sticky morass. The shell holes, where they do not actually merge into one another, are divided only by a few inches of this glutinous mud. The gunners work thigh-deep in water. Artillery pieces dug themselves into the muck with their recoil, some of them disappearing entirely under the surface. The crew would mark the spot with a flag. Private Charlie Miles of the Royal Fusiliers reported that the moment you set off, you felt that dreadful suction. In a way, it was worse when the mud didn't suck you down. Then you knew that it was a body you were treading on. It was terrifying. You'd tread on one on the stomach, perhaps, and it would grunt all the air out. The smell could make you vomit. Air reconnaissance was impossible. When the infantry attack began, men and equipment got hopelessly stuck. Horses pulling ammunition wagons sank up to their stomachs and had to be pulled out by huge teams of soldiers. Advancing troops trying to dig in found that all they could do was to throw up small mounds of sodden earth and lie down in puddles behind them. Thousands literally drowned in the mud, and yet they kept on, and kept on, and on, and on. The attack gradually dwindled into a near stalemate over a three-month period. More than 1 million casualties in that one battle. The death toll was 310,000. That's right. 310 dead of wounds, sickness, drowning, and freezing in this one battle. The numbers for the wider war are astonishing. In this great war, so inauspiciously begun, the total number of casualties, counting both military personnel and civilians, was to exceed 37 million. Including over 16 million fatalities. When on April 2nd, 1917, a reluctant Woodrow Wilson finally approached Congress with a request for a declaration of war, he called the battle the nation was entering the most disastrous and terrible of all wars, and he was right. Our losses were lighter than those of our European allies, but they were substantial nevertheless. Among the fallen were many young people who left our university to fight. We should think of them whenever we walk onto campus from 45th Street along that grand colonnade of arching sycamores, where one tree has been planted for every University of Washington undergraduate who died in that war. When the facts of a situation are unimaginable, when they exceed the bounds of conventional thought, we turn to artists, painters, composers, poets, to help us put our emotions and thoughts into some form of comprehensible array. There is no more poignant visual appreciation of the plight of the soldiers gassed at Ypres than John Singer Sargent's epic painting, Gassed, in which a stumbling line of 10 soldiers, blinded by the bandages over their eyes, are being led across a killing field by a corpsman. The foreground and middle ground are filled with dozens of the dead and dying. In the background, another party of blinded soldiers is led out of the picture. Sargent severely restrained his palate. The sky is a long smear of smudgy greenish yellow, calling up the gas cloud itself. The soldiers' uniforms are the color of dried mud. Particularly striking the size and shape of the work, hanging in the Imperial War Museum in London. It's huge, 20 feet long, three times as wide as it is tall. The proportions lend a sense of the cinematic melancholy to the trudging procession. In his critical appraisal of this work, Michael Glover says, "This is Owen country, the pity of war." And indeed it is. Wilfred Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est is the greatest war poet's mournful commemoration of the Ypres campaign, its gas, its crushing brutality, and its human toll. The title comes from an ode by Horace. More fully, the slogan is, Dulce et Decorum Est pro patria mori. It is sweet and right to die for one's country. It was a rallying cry, often recited at the beginning of the war, when thousands were swept along by tunes of glory. Now the horrific denouement of trench warfare had turned the world upside down, and the slogan became bitter and hostile on the poet's lips. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or on lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud, of vile, uncurable souls, sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie. Dulce est decorum est pro patria mori. Not all of Owen's great war poetry is quite so angry, so morose. Perhaps in response to Robert Gray's urging of poets to cheer up and write more optimistically, Owen later wrote Apologia pro poemate meo, a defense of my poetry. It begins in the tone of the previous one. I too saw God through mud, the mud that caked on cheeks when wretches smiled. But then, halfway through the poem, comes a remarkable stanza, the stanza from which I've taken the title of this talk. I have perceived much beauty in the hoarse oaths that kept our courage straight, heard music in the silentness of duty, found peace where shell storms spouted reddest spate. My goodness, listen to that. Amidst all the desolation, suffering, and dread, beauty. Beauty and music. This jarring refrain is not a parody of ugly reality. Instead, it acknowledges a realization that often emerges in the midst of horror and devastation, perhaps is most likely to do so there. It is that Even in the presence of unspeakable suffering, people can rise up out of the mud and see with a lucidity they never saw before the virtues of tenacity, interdependence, and fellow feeling. There is on all sides, under all flags, something profoundly admirable in the love born of comradeship, something beautiful in the human effort to keep courage and hope alive. In the silentness of duty, the poet says, there is music to be heard. Music. I don't think Owen had in mind the popular ditties of the day that might run through a soldier's mind on a march. Keep the home fires burning. Wacht am Rhein. Over there, La Madelon. And it's a long way to Tipperary. Although we shouldn't disparage the comfort that these tunes brought to the troops. Rather, I think, Owen aimed to invoke the directness of music's deeper impact as a tonal analog of the emotive life of a given time in every human being. Music is famously a universal language, and the message it conveys is a lesson that transcends battle lines and flags. Words cannot say what Ravel's trio tells us about the tumultuous feelings of 1914, nor can they say what Bartok and Prokofiev found in the turbulent emotions of their worlds. The strain of maintaining what was left of the old, the fear of the unborn new. In Hungary, Bartok abandoned his mission of collecting peasant tunes from all over and turned to composition in an atmosphere of isolation and deprivation. Prokofiev's biographer tells us that the war cast a gloomy shadow over every aspect of Russian life and that the sharp impressions of the war years served to intensify the agitated and expressionistic qualities of the work, of his work. The music they wrote was born in an atmosphere of high hopes and of anguish at the immensity of suffering in this most horrible episode of human conflict. Even the worst of life's sorrows can show us something of the best of human spirit. And we can hear some of these qualities when we listen to our own hearts, even as we hear them in the music of the time. Owen wrote Apologia pro Poemate Meo between spells of shooting at Germans. So there's a measure of irony in the fact that his lines echo an observation made a century earlier by the greatest of German philosophers, Immanuel Kant. Owen spoke of beauty. Kant called it sublimity. But the shared idea is that there's a remarkable capacity in people everywhere to rebound from the most crushing of experiences with a sense of the unifying power of human expression. As Kant put it, when we look up into the inky darkness of the night sky or listen to the endless roar of the ocean, we feel at first that our powers of comprehension are altogether overwhelmed. We're thrown down by the enormity of it all. And yet in the next moment, we rise up and think to ourselves, even beaten down as I am, I'm aware that there is a capacity in the human spirit, one that I share with everyone, everywhere, of facing enormity and responding to it with dignity. Owen speaks of peace where shell storms spouted red as blood. The peace he alludes to is no mere hiatus in the noise of the battlefield, but the adumbration of a more profound and lasting peace. Recognizing the power of reason and compassion on all sides, it is the hope that this great conflict might really be the war to end all wars. Seen in that light, the beauty, the music, the peace in that remarkable stanza are gestures toward a future purged of the temptation to make war by the searing lessons of this one. The war had become so horrible that it was no longer just a war against the enemy. It was a war against war itself. Peace did come, of course, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. Thomas Hardy wrote of it with appropriately mixed emotions. Calm fell. From heaven distilled a clemency. There was peace on earth and silence in the sky. Some could not shake off misery. The sinister spirit sneered, it had to be. And again the spirit of pity whispered, why? Of all poems written in the Great War, I suppose the one that has been recited most is by Lawrence Binyon. It's been read ever since and still is today at remembrance services in Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. It invokes in music, it invokes music to carry its message. In part it reads, solemn the drums trill, death Augustan royal sings sorrow up into immortal spheres. There is music in the midst of desolation and a glory that shines upon our tears. They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall not grow old, as we are that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them. Is this dulce et decorum spilling down to our own day? I don't think so. It doesn't pump up the pride of battle and pin medals on the glory of combat. Instead, it simply mourns and remembers. And its poignancy is a function of the sad and obvious truth that the war to end all wars failed to do so. Since the end of the Great War, wars have piled upon wars, so much so that we have had little time for peace. In concluding, I turn once more to Wilfred Owen, for it is he, I think, who most successfully expressed the felt reality of the trench warrior, laden with the muck of the battlefield, beset by the misery and madness of seemingly endless campaigns, yet mindful, as I have said, of the deep values of tenacity, interdependence, and fellow feeling that shone forth in them. Owen enlisted in 1915 and fought at the front, suffered a concussion when he fell into a shell hole, got blown into the air by a trench mortar, spent several days lying out on the field with the remains of a fellow officer, and was awarded the Military Cross for his bravery in leading an attack on enemy strongholds in France. He had never published a book, but he had in his knapsack a collection of poetry that critics have since hailed as the finest body of poetry about the experience of the war, of war written in the 20th century. At noon on November 11th, 1918, 1 hour after the armistice had begun, with the bells of celebration ringing all around, his mother received a black-bordered War Office telegram telling her that her son had been killed in action a week earlier. He was 25 years old. Nothing could express more eloquently the notion of music in the silentness of duty than Owen's poem, Anthem for Doomed Youth. It is one of several that Benjamin Britten later incorporated into his powerful musical rendition, his powerful musical meditation on the sorrows and sacrifices of the war, the War Requiem. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns. Only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries now for them. No prayers, no bells. No nor any voice of mourning save the choirs. The shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells and bugles calling for them from sad shires.
And bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles they beheld to speed them on.
So when we last talked in December, we talked a little bit about Bartok, how the First World War basically benched him from his ethnographic work. He was an enthusiastic traveler, got as far as North Africa in 1912. You're going to hear some of the results of that. Bartok was extremely dedicated to folk music and to researching. There is even a story, perhaps partly made up. He was in a hotel room in a small village in Transylvania, and he heard the maid cleaning in the next room, and she was singing a particular folk tune. And he ran into this room with his primitive little tape recorder and said, "Please, please sing that again." And she did. And these are the kinds of tunes that made their way into Bartok's music. This was 1913, 1914 was a very discouraging time for him. If you remember, I told you how brutal the critics had been about his music. There was a review in the Musical Quarterly that said, "Mr. Bartok stomps across the piano in his boots." Now, I'm going to give you a little excerpt from one of the pieces that caused all the ruckus. And he called it Allegro in F-sharp minor. So here's a little tiny taste of this Allegro in F-sharp minor. Now, the critics did not like that piece. It perhaps is a little angular, but I wouldn't exactly call it barbaric. But the critics said, he's a barbaric composer. So Bartok at that point said, you know what, I'll show them. Let's rename this piece Allegro Barbaro. And to this day, it is known by that name. Bartok is not perhaps for everyone immediately. I remember I made my first CD, an all-list recording, and the second CD was all Bartok. And I called my mother and I said, well, how did you like the list? I loved it. And how did you like the Bartok? She said, well, I put it on when I want to get my housework done. Not to be disparaging, but there is something very energized about this kind of music. Now you're about to hear a cycle which was among his most popular pieces, originally written for piano solo, these Romanian dances. They've also been transcribed for violin and piano, as you'll hear, flute and piano. And this is, again, Bartok in emanating the folk. You'll hear these different kinds of dances, country dances. You'll hear a little flavor of Arabic, Arabian music, very sinuous, serpentine kind of gorgeous sounds. You'll also hear a lot of asymmetry, and Bulgarian, Romanian dances are famous for this kind of an uneven time. Let me give you a little example. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two. Keeps you a little bit off your feet. Very compelling, actually. You're going to hear some of these in the polka rhythms. So again, from about 1914, one of the real products of his ethnography, his love of different culture. This is Bartok's Romanian Dances, and please help me welcome Corey and Jane. Thank you. A rip-roaring beginning. The sonata you're about to hear of Prokofiev is not one of his better known. I find that sort of sad, rather, because I'm terribly fond of this. This piece was written and dedicated to a conservatory pal of Prokofiev's by the name of Schmidhoff, who actually committed suicide. And Prokofiev dedicated several of his works to Schmidhoff. This piece begins very darkly, but intriguingly so. And with that dark kind of almost Russian basso kind of opening, there's also some beautiful passages which really remind me of Russian fairy tales. They're very mystical, they're very beautiful, translucent. Perhaps the capstone for me is the second movement. And I think you will hear funeral bells, children's tunes, something very ethereal and yet very dark and mystical. Prokofiev must have been very fond of the slow movement because he also orchestrated it. Now, after the darkness, the foreboding, there is the most wonderful finale, which is in C major. It harkens back to Prokofiev's classical symphony, exuberant, as if you saw your very best friend coming down the street towards you and you didn't expect to see him. You didn't even know he was in town, and here he is coming towards you. This is music of the greatest exuberance. So these three movements, for me, form something very compelling. We've talked about Bartok's wish to enlist. You're going to hear more about Ravel than Ron told you. Prokofiev is a complicated case. He was a bit apolitical. So much so that he took a desperate measure. He was a wonderful pianist, but when the war broke out, he elected to go back to the conservatory as an organ major. A desperate step indeed. Since my organ colleague is not here today, I can say that. But at any rate, creative, and we won't say much more about, we shouldn't be critical or non-critical. Prokofiev's politics became more problematic for him as the Second World War came and afterwards when he went to Paris. So it's a difficult situation. Nonetheless, a great musician, a great artist, certainly a lover of his country. So here to play the fourth sonata is Lydia. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
The second half of the program with Maurice Ravel is emblematic of a composer deeply affected by the war, deeply. We couldn't have Ravel represented without something from Le Tombeau. So I persuaded Li Chen to play for you this exquisite little minuet from the cycle. I say little, not in any deprecating way, it's just that it's a brief piece. Ravel wrote each piece in the Le Tombeau naming a friend who died in the battlefield. So this particular little minuet is dedicated to a Colonel Dreyfus, not to be mixed up with the infamous Dreyfus, a completely different Dreyfus. It is an elegant little first theme in G major, serene, chaste, solemn. And then there's an interesting middle part, which he calls a musette. Now, the musette is a kind of instrument which basically is related to the bagpipe or the hurdy-gurdy or the drone. Now, I don't mean the kind of drone that looks to see whether you're sorting your garbage correctly these days. This is the early drone from 15th century French courts, which was blown, a blown instrument. Therefore, no lady was to play the drone. It was not considered ladylike to blow into anything. So it was played by only men. It had a very narrow pitch range. And so Ravel imitates this very solemn, kind of funereal little drone in the beginning and in the middle of the piece. Let me show you just a little bit of the texture. Very, very dark, very solemn, very narrow pitch because the drone or the bagpipe only has a certain number of pitches. So the outsides of the minuet are in a rather bright G major, and then he turns down the lights in this middle section with this very somber but extremely beautiful. So this is a brief evocation, again, in memory of one of the soldiers in Le Tombeau. You should also notice that the title of the piece, The Death of Couperin, Ravel himself painted a funerary urn on the cover of the music. It's an urn with some smoke arising from it, and he was that determined that this would be a memorial. And he says, well, I'm not just honoring Couperin, but all the musicians of that century, Couperin being the great father, I suppose, of classical music and mathematics and all that. But an amazing piece. The last movement of the tombeau is called a toccata. And, you know, Ravel wanted to be in the Air Force. Ron didn't mention that to you, but that was his first dream. He was enamored of airplanes. Everyone was at that time. And there's actually some imitations of the airplane engine in the toccata. So it's not all somber, but the piece you're going to hear, I think, is a beautiful evocation of honoring both life and death. So here's Li Chen to play the minuet.
Thank you.
think the stagehands are going to want to set up for the trio, so let me just, while they're perhaps working, I'll just talk a little minute of more. The poem I selected for this program is a bit of a dark one, and a few of my friends even teased me and said, Robin, that's not a very cheery little poem. It's not, but I want to credit Thomas Hardy more than any other poet with being clairvoyant about the war. Professor Moore alluded to that. This particular poem, the mistress hearing someone scratching on her grave, thinks it's all her best friends or her lover. It's none of them. They've long forgotten her. And even though it's her faithful little dog, he didn't come back to check on her. He simply forgot where he buried a bone. All war is ironic because all war is worse than expected. The outcome is nothing like people expect. Thomas Hardy wrote another poem called Channel Firings. This, again, is before the war. The residents of a seaside cemetery are slumbering off the coast of Cornwall, and they hear gunfire out in the channel. Gunfire, and they say to each other, oh my goodness, this must be the end of the world. Is it the end of the world? God speaks down to them and says, no, no, this is not the end of the world. The world goes on just as before, stupid, primitive, brutal. But I have something much warmer and much more punitive in store for you at the end of the world. Again, before the war, the sense of irony. This was a 4.5-year tsunami of destruction which permanently darkened our worldview. And Professor Moore's wonderful talk about the trenches. Do you know that the French built 6,000 miles of trenches, the English another 6,000, the Axis Central Powers another 13,000, 26,000 miles of trenches could encircle the earth. And the most profound irony about the trenches for the boys from Britain, guess what? They were 70 miles from home, 70 miles from a plush theater seat of velvet in London. And that was an immense irony for them. They simply couldn't get over the fact that they were a boat ride from home. They got the post just the day after the London papers arrived in these trenches. And when you think about that horrible proximity for an England which had fought all its wars in remote parts of the land, here we were, 70 miles from home. So this idea of the voluminous ironies, we've talked about a few of them in the last program, just incredible. Now, as Ron told you, Ravel wrote this trio in a fever. He was in a fever. He was enlisting as best he could as an ambulance driver. But he writes to his composer friend, all the while I'm writing this trio, I am sobbing over my sharps and my flats. Because he just couldn't come to grips with what was happening to the world. It just absolutely destroyed him. You are about to hear one of the most difficult piano trios written, and I don't say that to scare the kiddos because they're well up to it. But a few little brief words about this trio is basically based on a Basque folk song and poem. It's a dance called the Zorzitska, and the main thing is Ravel's paying homage to his Basque roots. The interesting thing about this is its poetry of each line is 7 syllables, which gives it a kind of interesting arrhythmia. And Ravel, out of this very simple 4 little phrases, creates an entire piano trio. So I'm going to show you these 4 extremely simple sentences, if you think of them. They each have 7 syllables. So the first, the second, third, and fourth. You can say, Robin, consummately simple. Yes, and that's why it will yield such wonderful treasures in all the variations and permutations you're going to hear it in. So the first movement, the piano has this serene, solemn theme, and then the cello and violin come in and take it to a fever pitch. The pontoum is based on a melee poem, a different kind of structure. Again, it will use the same theme, and it's exotic. It's tinged with Asian colors and tambourines and a little bit of Borodin. The Passacaglia begins almost as a rabbinical canon. You can imagine the rabbi intoning this sepulchral theme in the bass and keeps that theme tragic, actually tragic. And then all the bells and whistles come back in the finale, Anime, and you hear that same simple theme in Technicolor. In Technicolor, Cecil B. DeMille, right there. Bucketfuls of notes for the pianist, bucketfuls. No less difficult, the cello is often up in no man's land, I should say nosebleed land, I always tease them, way up high with the harmonics. A superb piece, again, written at a time of, in a way, mental desolation, mental desperation, but still, as Ron said, out of this abyss comes the urge to create and to make music, which will go on long after us. So please welcome the Andromeda Trio to play Ravel.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you enjoyed this presentation, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Professor Ronald Moore teaches in the University of Washington Department of Philosophy. Professor Robin McCabe teaches in the UW School of Music. The University of Washington presented this talk and concert at the Breishman Auditorium on Sunday, March 8, 2014. Many thanks to the performers and Mr. Gary Louie for this recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.